Welcome to In the Middle. I'm Joey Block. A happy Thanksgiving weekend to you. Hope you have some good eats in your future, or in case you are listening to this after the fact, hopefully you had some good eats, that you had something good to eat, and are spending time with friends, families, the loved ones in your life. So hopefully you get some good time there and enjoying the weekend and getting away from the politics that have been plaguing our country the last couple months with a presidential campaign and now soon to be a gubernatorial campaign here in New Jersey. So obviously a lot to talk about. So hopefully politics doesn't come up at the table if you're not comfortable talking about it. And if it does, hopefully you can talk about it in a respectful way. Maybe you all agree, maybe you all don't. Either way, hopefully you are enjoying your Thanksgiving weekend and having some quality time with the people you care about. So anyways, thank you for joining me here. We do have to discuss politics on this show. So if you did carve out the time during Thanksgiving weekend for us, thank you for that. It's obviously you have a lot going on. You're probably getting ready to do the Black Friday shopping if you haven't already done it. The Cyber Monday, you're prepping for that. Maybe you just got some shopping to do in general. Or you got to put up the Christmas tree in case you haven't done it already. Some people do it now November 1st, if you can believe it or not. I'm not that kind of guy. I'm kind of a guy who likes to do it on Thanksgiving or Black Friday, something like that. So maybe putting up the Christmas tree, getting up the Christmas decorations, the Hanukkah decorations for our Jewish listeners, Kwanzaa, if you're into that too. Whatever you celebrate, maybe you're doing all that. But either way, thank you for carving out some time here. We have a lot to discuss, including the drama over President-elect Trump's legal cases. We are finally in what may be the beginning of the end for his legal challenges. Judge Tanya Chutkan has dismissed President-elect Trump's federal election case. It came just hours after special counsel Jack Smith filed a motion in federal court to drop the charges against Trump. So there were four charges in this case, and two of them were revolving around obstruction of a public proceeding. Both of those are dropped along with the other two. The Justice Department's longstanding policy on this has been you can't indict a sitting president or charge them with a crime. That's the reasoning that Jack Smith used to say, we can't move any further with this. So Smith cited this in his filing, saying, quote, that prohibition is categorical and does not turn on the gravity of the crimes charged, the strength of the government's proof, or the merits of the prosecution, which the government stands fully behind. The government's position on the merits of the defendant's prosecution has not changed, but the circumstances have. Of course, alluding to the fact that President-elect Trump will be returning to the White House on January 20th. Now, the DOJ's policy, it's important to point this out here, notes that Congress has the power to impeach a president if they commit a crime, and then the department can charge them from there if they are removed from office. So that's once they are removed, then they are a regular civilian and the DOJ policy no longer applies. This comes on the same day that the special counsel moved to drop his appeal of a ruling in federal court that dismissed Trump's classified documents case. Smith says he's dropping those charges because of DOJ policy, but is still charting the court when it comes to two other co-defendants in the case, Walt Nauta and Carlos de Oliveira. In the filing, Smith wrote, quote, the appeal concerning the other two defendants will continue because, unlike Defendant Trump, no principle of temporary immunity applies to them, close quote. Now, this is important to note here. The Trump administration could move to withdraw the appeal against the two men, or even the former president could pardon them upon taking office once again. Now, Judge Eileen Cannon previously dismissed the case against Trump, Nada, and D'Oliveira on the grounds that Smith was unlawfully appointed. So, obviously, these cases have generated a lot of buzz and a lot of interest into why someone would go after the former president when he was out of office. Also, why you would do it on an election year, as well as the very merits of these charges that are in place. Because, as you know, there's a lot of legal debate, and we've discussed this several times on this show, about these charges. Especially when it comes to the federal election case, there are some Supreme Court rulings now to cite that could have potentially caused massive roadblocks if Smith were even to continue the case. Let's say, you know, they put a pause button on this while Trump was in the White House, and then 4 years later decided to keep this going. He would have to be facing the Supreme Court decision on presidential immunity and how that would be interpreted, as well as the January 6th ruling, which says that the Justice Department overcharged the obstruction of a public proceeding charge, which is two charges within Trump's indictment. So that throws out half the case. So it's harder for Smith to mess around with this. Remember, that's why Smith did a lot of these edits in this. He was basically trying to make it sound like, because the immunity decision revolved around the fact that you couldn't really charge him. The president had immunity for things he did that were related to an official duty. That's kind of in the framework. So he tried to rewrite the indictments to make it sound like these people were campaign people, political operatives, people who were not directly associated with the White House. And that is what we're seeing is probably something that could be problematic. The reason being, if you even go back to the New York case, where the crutch of the testimony in that case was based on former White House communications director Hope Hicks, who some might argue was serving in an official government role at the time when they were talking about the evidence in which she was talking about, you know, Trump and the payments, and that she was conducting an official White House business and Trump and her were discussing that, and that you couldn't use that because that would be one of the things that Trump is shielded from as part of this presidential immunity decision. So taking that logic, it is harder to go after the election case where Trump challenged the election results, but at the same time, these were, if you argued it was a part of official acts to ensure the security election, and again, that's the thinking from the Trump camp, then it's harder to prosecute these people and use them as evidence, such as Mike Pence, for example. They treat him more as a campaign surrogate in the update indictment rather than the vice president of the United States, which is obviously the more crucial role in this and the more significant one. So for Smith, the calculation might have been, hey, this is really going down the drain here. I'm probably getting fired anyways, because remember, Trump said multiple times on day one, I'm firing Jack Smith in the first 5 seconds. Done. I'm getting rid of him. So either Trump himself would do the act, or Pam Bondi, who potentially could be the next attorney general, might say to Jack Smith to take a hike. So in that regard, it could be that he sees there's an uphill battle to keep his work going, and it's best to wrap it up. And that is why, with the federal election case, he might have just threw in the towel and said he was done. Now, with the classified documents thing, it's kind of a different deal because there are more serious charges that are being dealt with. And for a lot of legal experts out there, they have said this could have potentially been the most damaging case against Trump. So if that's the case, you might want to keep it around, right? Well, the judge in that case, as I mentioned earlier, Eileen Cannon, she basically said, we're dismissing it on constitutional matters of Smith being unlawfully appointed. There are some questions of whether it had to be through Congress and yada, 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 and or whether there are specific requirements for a special counsel and of the like. It's a whole constitutional argument that has a lot of law and legal documents behind it. But that is essentially why she said goodbye to this entire case, including the two other defendants. But Smith is trying to continue on with those with the argument of saying, whoa, hold on here. Trump, we can't do anything about, but these two guys are not covered by that. They're not White House officials. They're not presidents. Either one of them are going to be president. They are regular people. And that's why Smith's going through. But, you know, given the fact that the Trump team will be running the Justice Department, the likelihood that they're going to continue on because Smith is, you know, all but rumored to be stepping down at this point, and most likely, given the fact that Trump has expressed animosity towards him, then it's going to be harder for someone to pick up the mantle and continue on this prosecution. But of course, these charges are very serious if they are to come to pass, of moving around classified documents related to Iran and foreign adversaries and of the like, and what the involvement was with these two men and what they knew and when, and did they know they were moving documents around that were classified. That's harder to go into, and it's more difficult considering you can't use anything in regard to Trump because Trump is the center of the whole thing. Now, there are legal experts who say this could bog down his administration somewhat. That depends whether his Justice Department continues on. Then that would create an interesting tension between him and Bondi. Because as you remember from the first administration, when Jeff Sessions was involved with the Russia investigation, he was very active in Trump's 2016 campaign. So there was pressure from the legal community for Sessions to recuse himself from the investigation and have his deputy, Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, run the show. So that's what he did, and that pissed off Trump to the point where Sessions kind of got voted out off the island, give or take, given the say, of the Trump world. He kind of went out of the fold. So then that kind of created tension and resulted in Bill Barr being put in the role of Attorney General. And as you recall, Barr also had a dramatic exit there because they had disagreements over the January 6th stuff and even really before that with the election challenges, and he was trying to pressure Barr, allegedly, to pursue charges on that from the Justice Department, and Barr was not having it. And from there, he put in acting Attorney General Matt Whitaker, who is now going to serve as NATO ambassador, by the way, if he gets confirmed. So interesting fact there. So that would also be an interesting dynamic if the Justice Department continued on with the charges against these co-defendants and not Trump himself. But a lot of uphill battles, like I said. So we will see if that's the case. But for Trump, it's interesting the politics around this, because this is essentially he was using as the rallying cry for his base when seeking re-election. That these people are out to get me and I'm standing in their way. They're really looking for you and we got to vanquish them. And if we do, then all these cases will be gone and we're going to have fair and equal justice in this country again. So he made this argument, and now you're starting to see a little bit of maybe either his prophecy, or you could argue he does not have that same political weapon anymore because now these charges are evaporating. Now, obviously, he still has to deal with the impending sentencing of the New York criminal trial because he got convicted there, and Judge Juan Merchan really has to sit there with himself and decide what he wants to do about it because he's got a lot of things to think about, including the delaying of the sentencing, which it seems like everybody's open to moving to 2029. He may just do that, press the pause button, and give himself 5 years to really think about it. Or he could weigh the presidential immunity decision and say, you know what, I don't know if I really agree with it, but based on that court's ruling, the Supreme Court, we have to honor it, and we're going to have to dismiss this case because of the fact that evidence was used from someone who was in official White House capacity. Again, we'll have to see if they go that far, but it's questionable whether Smith and Bragg and all these people are going to go accept that direction and whether the judges in this case are going to accept it. Then, of course, you have Georgia, where right now they're trying to go through the court system to Georgia State Supreme Court, seeing what happened there, whether they can get that rule on based on Fannie Willis's activities with her former top prosecutor in the case, Nathan Wade. A lot of drama there. So for Trump, he has to play it politically right. Do you want to keep talking about these cases that are going on forever? Would you like to move on? Do these cases help Trump make this argument, even if his people are running the Justice Department? That's a question we have to figure out politically. Now, for Democrats, they also have their own complicated math they have to figure out. They have to make the calculation of whether it's a good idea to continue on with that lingo that they've been going on about for the last 3 years, that Trump is a four-time indicted, convicted felon. They like to paint him as a criminal. And now that he's going to be serving in the highest office in the land, do you want to continue to paint a guy like that in a negative light? And could it turn against you because the American people expect to give the current president of the United States some form of respect? That could be a thorny issue for them. But at the same time, where they're trying to consolidate the party behind a future leader, and obviously there's rumors about whether Harris is going to run for president or governor or whatever, but they are in the middle of trying to find their identity. Is it a good idea to continue out the Trump stuff? Because that's kind of what they tried to do in this election, and it didn't really play the same way they thought it was going to. So now the Democrats have to weigh, how much do they want to weigh into these cases? Do they want to continue going the rah, 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 we hate Trump kind of thing, he's corrupt, two-tier justice system, but not in the way you think? Or do they just want to ignore it and move on and try to unify the country and focus more on the issues rather than these legal cases? Over the next 4 years, we're going to have a lot of these questions answered. But you can assure as we go into this holiday season that these legal questions will linger. And we may get some answers out of New York. What we're going to figure out, well, in the next week we may have something. We shall see where we go from there. But here's what we're getting in the middle of this week. While we have the presidential election in the books, there are still questions regarding polling. Now, why would you ask? Well, especially since the races ended up being tighter than a lot of people expected, not just on the presidential race, but also with key Senate and House races. When you're looking at the polling in particular, the popular vote kind of was tight the way it expected. Depending on which media outlet you're looking at, it's somewhere between 49.9% and 50% for the president-elect, and about 48% for the current vice president. So tight on that end, but if you look at the battleground states, Trump dominated when it came to them. He ended up claiming all seven of them, despite polling saying that Vice President Harris may have a shot at winning a couple in the Rust Belt. And some of these margins are actually larger than some people may have expected. Then, when you look at our state in particular, New Jersey, Trump actually came within 6 points of flipping the state, something we haven't seen since 1992 when Bill Clinton originally flipped the state blue and turned it into a Democratic stronghold for the last 30 years or so. And then on the Senate side, you had Andy Kim still win. He was the expected winner there, but Curtis Bashaw kept things pretty competitive. That was within 9 points. And if you looked at the polling for that, it actually was saying a different story. We thought that the Senate race was going to be much wider than we expected. The final polling for that race with Research Company poll, they had it, let's see the race there. Well, for president, it was 58% to 41%. And then for the Senate race, they had it 58% to 40. And that was also similar case with Fairleigh Dickinson. They had a poll that also get Andy Kim a lead. And that margin was, if I want to get it correctly here, it was within, I would say, double digits more or less. And Rutgers had their polling where Harris was going to win the state by 20 points. Now, we want to say they are polls, but we want to dig into why these numbers may be different. What's the difference in that? Why did we get the results we get? And what can we learn from the polling industry going forward? Well, I have two pollsters with me now who each run polls from, I would say, the gold standard when it comes to New Jersey. And that would be Rutgers Eagleton Institute Center of Public Polling Director Ashley Koning and Fairleigh Dickinson University Poll Executive Director Dan Cassino. Thank you both so much for joining me. Really appreciate it.
Great to talk with you.
Thanks for having us.
So, Dan, I want to start off with you. Your last poll before the election put the presidential race within the margin of error nationally. You had Harris slightly up in this scenario. While we saw the popular vote ended up being tight as accurately predicted, the battleground states and the Electoral College turn out to give Trump a much larger lead than anticipated. Explain the discrepancies between all these numbers.
So the problem we had with polling, and not just at FDU, but with every poll going into this race, was actually with turnout. So pollsters since 2016, when there's a big polling miss, really based on the demographics of who's actually voting, I think pollsters to a great extent have fixed that problem. We know to wait for education, and recently we started reading a lot of polls on rural, urban, suburban. The biggest problem we have, though, in the U.S. is with likely voter models. You know, we ask people, are you going to vote in this election? We can actually go back and find people who have voted and make sure the people we're polling are the people who have voted in the past. And we, most of us, do that. The problem is when we ask people, are you going to vote? Everybody says yes. And a bunch of those people are lying. So we have to figure out who's lying and who's not. And generally, we assume if someone voted in the past, they're going to vote this time. What happened this last election is that just didn't happen. We had a whole bunch of people who had voted in the past who said they were going to vote. And among them, a lot of Democrats who just didn't show up at the polls that you saw, especially in New Jersey, where you just had a collapse in Democratic turnout. So this is less about a problem with the polling and more about a problem of, you know, figuring out who is going to vote and who isn't. And I think even the Democrats, Democratic strategists I talked to, Democratic elected officials, were also shocked at how much the Democrats just didn't show up. Here in New Jersey, the big example of that was in Passaic County, it's not that the margins were off. It's that about 20,000, 50,000 Democrats who had voted in the past just didn't show up. And that's not a sort of issue we can really figure out just through polling.
Ashley, going into this election, polls showed Harris possibly winning Michigan and Wisconsin, even Pennsylvania, but that ultimately didn't happen. When you and I last spoke after the midterms, you said the reason why there was such a shock among political junkies about the results of that election, it could be contributed to moods and vibes as well as single anecdotes. Could that have also played a factor in why some of these polls overestimated Harris's appeal?
Yeah, you know, I think we should recognize that polls actually did pretty darn well this election cycle, much like in 2018 and 2022. I think claiming this narrative that the polls were a massive failure once again for the third time in a row is really the wrong mindset. What I think we need to do is a better job of understanding, media included, the public included, pollsters trying to educate better in terms of what these close results mean leading into an election. And all of those top national pollsters and forecasters leading to election day were saying, yes, these states, these battlegrounds are on a knife's edge. We're seeing a difference of 1 point one way or 1 point the other way. These states could really go either way. So we knew heading into this, it was a close race. And that closeness of the race told us that potentially there could be anywhere from a solid win to a landslide for either one of these candidates, depending on turnout. And like Dan said, turnout is really key here, right? That is the bulk of the formula of what actually happens on election day. You know, polls are what people are telling us, what they say and what they think. It's not what they're going to do. It's not the action they take at the polls on election day or leading up to it. So, you know, I think what we saw was a lot of Democrats sitting home, a lot of anger that was emanating from particular voting blocks, making them either turn for Trump or staying home in particular. We saw particularly in Dearborn, Michigan, that those uncommitted votes we saw in the primaries against Biden turned into potential Trump votes within Dearborn that had a strong Arab population. And so, you know, really turnout is the key here, and polls can really only tell us so much leading up to that. But I do think we have to give credit that polls are not meant to necessarily predict, but we're telling us that as of that snapshot in time, those pre-election polls told us the race was close, told us it could really go either way.
Yeah, and look, the fact that the overall popular vote was then, you know, within a point or two, I mean, that's in the polls on average. Look at the polling averages nationally. Yeah, it said it was basically tied. Winds up being a point or two. That's within what you expect from it. I mean, all you can expect from the polls, they say it's going to be close, and it turned out to be close. Figure out the margins, well, that's quite a bit more difficult.
Yeah, Ashley, specifically speaking on the margin of error, how much of that is really forgotten when it comes to media coverage? Because you often, you know, you see at the bottom of the screen, like if you're watching TV or something, oh, well, the margin of error is 3.5 and plus or minus or whatever. But you really see these numbers at the top where it looks like candidates may have a larger lead than's actually expected. Do media pundits and outlets need to pay more attention to that margin of error? Would that provide more credibility to your industry when you look at final results that may look different than what people were expecting?
Yeah, Joey, I think that's an excellent point. And that's something we all need to educate ourselves better on. Both pollsters educating the press and the press and pollsters educating the public. Once again, we're all intertwined within this political process, and polls are meant to educate and to inform and to make for this, you know, if we want to talk about the rose-colored glasses view, truer form of democracy. And it is crucial to understand, especially in election cycles, what the margin of error is. So we're dealing with simply estimates. That's what surveys are. They are blunt instruments that are talking about estimates of the population. And while we generalize those numbers back to the population, there's an inherent uncertainty within those numbers because these are exercises in statistics. I still believe it is the best, most representative quantitative form we have of assessing public sentiment and assessing possible participation within the political process. But we have to understand that there is like this range that these survey estimates actually lie within. So when we're reporting these numbers, they're not numbers that are etched in stone. It's not the gospel. Everybody interprets that we see these concrete numbers and therefore it must be true. The race must be at 51-49 or 52-48. But really what we're talking about is kind of ranges of numbers. And I think explaining how the margin of error applies to those numbers, especially in head-to-head, that the margin of error is applying to both of these candidates. And not even are we talking about the margin of error number we see on a page or on a website or on a media clip, but we're actually talking about probably doubling that amount because of all sorts of error. You know, I think that's a really important, albeit complicated, conversation to have. But it would go a long way for us to better understanding the polling process and understand that these numbers that get published are actually within kind of this range of numbers if we had actually talked to everybody in the population. And, you know, some pollsters are showing that more and more through graphics, trying to show kind of where those cutoffs are, where the lower confidence interval is, where the upper boundary is. But it's, again, it's a difficult conversation to have, but it is something that is incredibly important to understanding how to interpret polls and when not to use polls when we're talking about pre-election cycles.
And really, Joey, I mean, part of this is that the media is asking polls to do something that polls are not designed to do. I mean, polls are very good at gauging public opinion. They're not good at predicting the future. That's real hard. And that's not what polls are for. I mean, I think almost every pollster I know, if you ask them, they would rather not poll elections because there's no reason to poll elections because we're all going to find out what's going to happen the same day anyway, whether we have the polling or not. The best function of polling is on public interest polling, where we're polling about, you know, issues that are coming up in our states. We're polling about legislation that's coming up to educate not just the public, but educate legislators about what the public wants. That's serving democracy. And that's what polls are really good at. The election polling is, you know, what we do because the media and the public really wants that. They want to know what's going to happen in the future. And they have to understand it's you're always going to have a big margin of error around those numbers.
And let's remember also when we're talking about pre-election polling, it's the only instance of polling where we are trying to survey an unknown population. We don't know who's going to turn out and vote. We're trying to make an educated guess about that. But when we do issue polling, which Dan and I frequently do, we know the population. It's the general population of New Jerseyans. That is a given. We know who those people are. We have absolutely no clue who a likely voter is. And sometimes it's not the same people we saw in a previous election cycle. It very well is often not. And again, we have surprises where low propensity, low information voters are turning out, especially when Trump is at the top of the ballot. And so it becomes incredibly difficult for any pollster, national or statewide, to predict who is actually going to turn out. And again, it's not our job.
Yeah. And so I actually did some polling in Turkey, which has mandatory turnout. You know, everyone has to vote. And boy, it was wonderful. Like no likely voter models. Everyone has to vote. It's great. And you're actually going to see this, Joey, coming up in next year's election, the gubernatorial election, where, you know, we based our likely voter models on who's voted in similar elections in the past. We're going to have a competitive Democratic primary, a competitive Republican primary for the governor's race. We haven't had a competitive Democratic primary for the governor's race in 20 years. No one has any clue what a likely voter looks like in that race. So all the polling of that should be taken with large, large quantities of salt. Except for mine. Those are going to be great. Ashley's going to do pretty well, sure. I'm sure, too.
I'm sure Ashley would like to weigh in on hers because – Ashley, Rutgers-Eagleton has already done some initial polling of the gubernatorial race. It shows the candidates have a low name ID with Republicans, Democrats, and independent voters all mixed in. Now, it's important to note here that this is the same batch of polling that you did with the presidential race and the Senate race, where you had Harris winning New Jersey by 20 points and Andy Kim dominating in the Senate race by 23 points. How much weight should we put on these opinion polls this early in the game?
Well, Joey, let's remember, we didn't run head-to-heads for the gubernatorial. This was a test of what registered voters knew or know of these gubernatorial candidates. So this wasn't any type of prediction of, are they going to turn out for the gubernatorial? This is their favorability ratings as of right now. And if they actually recognize the names of who's running. So, you know, whatever the head-to-heads may have said, again, the head-to-heads are trying to reflect what may happen that is determined mainly by turnout on election day. This, again, we know the population of registered voters in the state. So these numbers aren't a mystery. We're not trying to predict any type of population other than the population of registered voters that already exists. So, you know, this is some pretty solid evidence that all of these candidates are lacking name recognition as of right now. This is simply assessing whether or not New Jersey voters know who each one of these candidates are. And if they do they have a favorable or unfavorable opinion of them? And we see that, you know, the picture is really stark here. On either side of the aisle, no candidate is viewed favorably by more than one in five voters. And at least half of voters do not take sides on any of the candidates that we asked about. Of course, this shouldn't be a surprise. We're ending a huge presidential cycle where all eyes were glued nationally. Voters within New Jersey and any other state are fatigued by politics in general. It's still going to be a fatiguing time going into a Trump administration in 2025. Voters are barely going to tune in time for the primary, most likely not in June 2025, and will likely mostly tune in by September 2025 when the gubernatorial is only a couple of months away. So there's a long time, but, you know, not that long, for these gubernatorial candidates to make headway with the public. But right now, I think they're more worried about making headway inside of their political parties in time for June, so somebody can look like a front runner going into this primary. But when it comes to the public, these candidates are simply not recognized right now.
Yeah, Joey, we did our first poll on most of these candidates in 2023. And honestly, the numbers have not moved very much since then. I mean, I know Sean Spiller's been putting out a lot of mailers, and Josh Gottheimer and Steve Fulop are on billboards all over the place. But voters still do not know who any of these people are. But again, that's, as Ashley was saying, that's not surprising. If we'd asked in 2016 if anyone knew who Phil Murphy was, people would have absolutely no idea. They'd think it was, remember, the Dropkick Murphys or something. So there's no way, you know, this is not surprising. But what's different is we're going to have a competitive primary. I mean, the party systems, I think, have lost a lot of the ability to dictate the primary. And that means it's actually competitive. Voters are going to matter. We just don't know who those voters are going to be.
Yeah, Ashley, I want to dive deeper into that, because the coalition of these voters that are voting for each party has rapidly changed over the last 8 years and really over the last few decades. A big part of the Republicans' coalition this year was minority voters, in particular Hispanics. Trump made major gains in Hispanic majority and plurality municipalities across the state. Does this complicate the polling in, you know, what was traditionally expected as a Democratic coalition now may actually be voting Republican? Does that change the game at all for you?
You know, I certainly don't think, and that's a great point, that we should be ignoring national patterns that we're seeing, because New Jersey politics has become more and more nationalized in terms of how these campaigns are run, in terms of what voters are thinking and feeling. I like to always kind of think that New Jersey had been immune, especially in this Trump era, for so long. And really, since 2021, we've seen national politics bleeding in. And of course, Latino voters, particularly Latino males, were a key voting bloc for Donald Trump this time around. So let's also not mistake the importance of the intersectional gender gap here with Latino male voters going for Trump this time around and flipping. And also, as that relates back to New Jersey, we saw two of those five counties that flipped for Trump within the Garden State include Passaic and Cumberland, both of which have significant Latino populations. So this is definitely something that both parties need to be aware of. And I think, honestly, each side of the aisle in New Jersey has some questions to answer and to think about within the next year. Democrats, obviously, what is their messaging going to be after Harris loss? And what are they going to focus on within New Jersey? We know that Cittarelli came close within striking distance of Murphy when he turned to those bread and butter issues. So are Democrats going to try to go more towards the middle within New Jersey? And for Republicans, are they going to embrace Trump? And is that going to be their platform within the Garden State? We know that the Garden State has really been a purple state. You know, we talk about being blue at the federal level because of Clinton onward, but we're a purple state. We've had Republican governors, but there's a certain kind of moderate Republicanism that New Jersey has embraced over the decades. And it'll be interesting to see, in a question for the GOP, whether or not that type of Republicanism is going to hold.
Yeah, you know, within the Republican Party, this is really the debate right now, is you've got people on the MAGA side within the New Jersey Republican Party saying, hey, you know, Trump did better than Curtis Bashaw. You know, you nominated a moderate who was on the fence, you know, back and forth about Trump for the Senate, and Trump outperforms him. So if you want to do better, you should nominate a Trumpy candidate, and on the Republican side, that's Bill Stadia. And, you know, that's a case they could make. I have trouble believing that a far-right Republican candidate would do very well in a statewide election, as possible, and the Democrats could always put up someone who's not going to do well statewide, too. So it's no one's thinking this is a race that the Democrats have in the bag on the gubernatorial levels. As you're saying, gubernatorial level, we've been a purple state for a long time.
Ashley, turnout was something we spoke about earlier in this conversation, trying to determine who is actually going to come out, that likely voter. Well, now the matter in which they turn out has far changed over the last 4 years or so. Early voting was up this year in New Jersey, marking the first time the method was used in the presidential race here in the state. Did early voting make it more difficult to determine where voters might lean? And could that be making this more difficult as we head into this gubernatorial campaign?
You know, I think it makes it more difficult for every pollster, whether we're talking national or statewide. Clearly, those organizations who deal with exit polling have had to significantly adjust their methods, given that early voting, both by mail and in person, has become prevalent across parts of the country. And so this is something that every pollster has to grapple with. You know, we ask voters if they've already voted. But again, you know, voters are telling us this information, and they could very well not be telling the truth. Voters that say that they're going to vote may not. Voters that say they won't may instead go out and vote and we not know. So again, this is based on what voters are actually conveying to us. So even if we're asking these questions about early voting, whether by mail or in person, or if you're voting on election day, we don't really know the actions and the actual, you know, physical steps that voters are going to take to accomplish their vote. But certainly, again, it makes it more difficult. And of course, we're looking at a very different electorate for the gubernatorial, you know, around half of what we would see typically in a presidential election, probably around 40% turnout, most likely, and especially when we talk about the primary, we're looking at voters who are more attentive, high information voters, high propensity voters. So we're looking at a very kind of different field as we go into both the primaries and then the general in November.
Yeah, well, and the other question there is, voter turnout, for instance, in the urban core areas is normally pretty low during the primaries because it's not competitive. In a competitive primary, do the party machines in Hudson County and Union County and Essex County, do they get out there and start turning out votes? If so, that makes a huge difference. And we're not going to have any way of really knowing that until election day. I mean, you know, look, I can poll whoever I want, but at the end of the day, I got to find out what Brian Stack is going to do. And that's a very different question. So this is, we're going to have a lot of things up in the air going into the gubernatorial election. But yeah, I would push back a little bit on the idea that, oh, there's this huge shift among Hispanics. There is a shift among Hispanics, as I said, among Hispanic men, a small shift among African-American men. But, you know, Hispanics have only really been a clear part of the Democratic coalition nationally since, like, you know, what, a little, you know, George Bush. I mean, George Bush in 2000 won Hispanics. I mean, so it's not this long-term thing. I think what you're really seeing is realignment, start of realignment at least, where American politics is less about race, more about education and gender. And that's a big shift. And I think we're all going to take some time to try and figure out exactly what that shift means.
Ashley, final word to you here. You were saying how this has become more of a nationalized race here in New Jersey. We typically focus more on the local issues like NJ Transit, etc. Is this going to be about what the next Trump administration is doing? Is this going to be the response to that? Is that what we're going to see? Or could we see somewhat of a return to local issues here in New Jersey next year?
Yeah, I think time will tell. But what's exciting for all of us is New Jersey becomes like this bellwether state along with Virginia in off cycles a year out from a presidential. And of course, a year before a midterm election across the country, all eyes go on New Jersey and Virginia in terms of what is the ideological mood? Are we potentially going to see some sort of ideological mood swing? And we have very, very often seen that depending on who the president is, we will often see a different party be elected as the governor. And so that'll be fascinating to see what kind of patterns emerge. You know, I think in 2021, we saw this focus on reproductive rights and talking about social issues that were front and center on the main stage. And again, Chitterelli really narrowing that gap in 2021, talking about the economy. And so I think that's, again, going to be front and center in the over 50 years of our polling. Property taxes and taxes in general have always been the most important issue to New Jerseyans. And so I think, you know, trying to understand kind of what happened this year and how New Jerseyans feel next year, several months into a Trump administration, is going to be crucial. You know, I think we also need to realize that a lot of these blue states around the country, like New Jersey, if we're talking about New York, Massachusetts, California, we saw these kind of mini red waves because a lot of these blue state voters feel comfortable with their rights and know that their rights are protected because of the social issue infrastructure within the state and the protections they have in that state. And therefore kind of voting almost as like a backlash and voting more for Republicans. So I think these are things to keep in mind heading into the gubernatorial and kind of what all of that means. I would not be surprised if we see a very large focus on the economy and commentary on the Trump administration.
Well, we'll have to see where this all goes over the next year. And I'm sure you'll all be following as pollsters. We'll be watching your polls and seeing where this shapes up. Rutgers Eagleton Institute Center of Public Polling Director Ashley Koning and Fairleigh Dickinson University Poll Executive Director Dan Cassino. Thank you both so much for joining me. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Joey.
Well, that about does it for me this week on In the Middle. Thank you so much for joining me as always. To stay in touch with the show, all you have to do is follow me on social media, which you can do on X at @Block_Joey. Again, my last name is spelled BLOCH_Joey. You can also check me out on Instagram at joey.block.39. Again, that is at joey.block.39. Now, in case you just found the show for the very first time, you're like, oh my God, I love the show. It's so great. But where do I go to find it? Well, here's what you need to do. You have to go to that browser of yours. You have to type in foxsportsradionewjersey.com/podcast. Again, that is foxsportsradionewjersey.com/podcast. You put that in, it'll take you right to the Fox Sports New Jersey podcast page. You're going to scroll down till you find In the Middle. You click on that and all the episodes will be there. You'll see the newest one at the top and the older ones at the bottom. We typically put out new episodes every Friday afternoon at 3 p.m. Well, thank you so much for listening. It has been a pleasure. I hope you and your family continue to have a great Thanksgiving Day weekend. We will be back here again in the middle with more great content here as we close out the year, as we, you know, put a bow on the presidential transition as well as the gubernatorial campaign beginning. We'll keep track of all that for you. This has been In the Middle. We'll be back next week with more In the Middle right here on Fox Sports, New Jersey.